This interview with Peter Scardoni is part of the Emeritus Faculty's Oral History Program, involving retired staff members of ANU who were part of the university in the early decades of its life. The Oral History Program was initiated and developed by ANU Emeritus Faculty as a contribution to university and community understanding of the beginnings and development of ANU over the past six decades. Emeritus faculty has a special interest in this era since the faculty's membership includes many of the people who helped shape ANU in its early days to make it the preeminent university it is today. Peter Scardoni was born in Bury on the south coast of New South Wales in 1944. Peter's family moved to Canberra in the 1950s, where Peter became one of the first students of St. Edmund's College. As a graduate from there in 1962, he found employment with ANU in its accounts section and has worked the rest of his professional life in financial and management positions in the university. He retired in 1999 but continues working from the campus as treasurer for emeritus faculty and provides pro bono help for a number of professional and charitable organisations. Well, thank you, Peter, for giving us this opportunity to talk to you about your ANU years. I notice that the number of those years is really quite astounding. I think you're the longest serving of all of the people that we've interviewed in this series, 47 years.
It's a long time. Yes.
Are you going to have a special occasion when you come to your 50th?
I think so.
Yeah. Right. So I'm sure a lot of us would like to help you help you celebrate that. But anyway, looking at your background, you were born in Bury. Yep. Presumably your family moved from there sometime.
Yeah, my father was a school teacher. He used to teach school in the Upper Kangaroo Valley in a little township called Watermolla, which consisted of a school and a post office. The school had a sort of one classroom for the whole school. We'd go through from kinder through to, in the intermediate in those days. School teachers got transferred. He was then transferred to Canberra in, 1949. We came in 1951,
Right.
I spent kindergarten in Bury and first class in Canberra.
He would have been one of the first teachers almost.
Yeah, he taught at Ainslie Primary School. He was a maths teacher there. He was a sort of a career school teacher. That's all he could be. He was from a family of five kids, three girls and two boys. Four of them were school teachers, and one man, the other, his brother, was a butcher.
A tradition in the family, as it were, that you then broke in.
Yeah.
And your sister, what turned out to be?
She was a career public servant in just secretarial type work.
Right. Yeah.
My father wrote a maths book for primary schools. The tragedy there was that he produced it in 1965 and they changed currency in 1966, so he wrote it in the old pound shillings and pence.
Yes.
Yes.
So that was a problem.
That was the end of that book.
Strange rules.
Yeah, we went to decimal.
That's we went from dozens to tens.
And,
exactly. So he moved, he would have been teaching presumably with the New South Wales Education Department, was he? And they moved here and... he then taught here.
Yep.
You then commenced school here. I noticed you went to St. Edmund's. Was that from when you were a youngster?
Yeah, I was in the first class that when the school opened in 1954, I was in fourth class and was the first one in the first class cohort to go all the way through the school.
I see.
To the leaving certificate.
So you're a valued graduate of the St. Edmunds
of the sense Edies, of
being
in
the first into the school itself. And do you maintain connection with them?
I'm clearly in their records. I yesterday got one of their school magazines. So over time, I've been to various reunions, but that's about it.
And can I ask? This might seem personal, but do you know why your parents sent you to a Catholic school when they were your father was working in a state school?
He was Church of England and my mother was Catholic. Mm. I don't think there was any marriages in our family that were of the same religion, so
yes.
I got a fairly, you couldn't call me prejudiced in any way or biased, but I think the understanding was if a man married a Catholic woman, then in those days it was required or part of the process that you went to a Catholic school.
I see,
and I
yes.
was baptised a Catholic as
right.
part of that.
Yeah, I see. So it was your mother's influence, as it were, in this case.
That the irony is that the Italian Scadoni was a Church of England, and my mother was English-Irish, and she was Catholic.
So where the name, Peter, is that, do you have to go far back to find any antecedents in Italy?
My grandfather was born in Italy, and my grandmother was, one in the north and one in the south. She was the northern one.
Parents of your mother or father?
Parents of my father.
Yes.
She was, I think, a chambermaid up close to the Swiss border and worked a little bit in Italy and Switzerland.
Right.
Emigrated to Australia separately. They met out here and married out here in Rutherglen. And there's a story about the Rutherglen Museum. There's a copy of a grocer's bound leather journal dated 1907. When I went there, when my wife, my past wife, was researching our family history, I saw it, and it was opened at the page 1907, and my grandfather paid his bills better than I did. Yeah, so they met out here and married out here, so they're full Italian. And my dad, whether he was born in Rutherglen, which makes him Australian-born, but of Italian, full Italian heritage.
Yes.
And I think on my mother's side, they were journalists. They printed the Tomorrah, was either Tomorrah Independent or Tomorrah Star. It's changed from one of those to what it is now. He moved from, my grandfather on my mother's side, moved to from Tomorrah to Bury to write and print the South Coast Register. That's where my father would have met my mother and where I came into the world.
I see, yes. Yeah. So after you finished then at St Edmunds, you, looking at your CV, you cast around for a job, effectively, as a school graduate.
Yeah.
And so you found a job at ANU?
Well, this is... Yes, I didn't actually. I went to get a reference from my headmaster. I was going to get a job in an insurance company. I missed a Commonwealth scholarship. I wanted to be a metallurgist. I went over to see him to get the reference, and he said, I have a chap here with a broken ankle. If you take him to the hospital, when you come back, I'll have your reference for you. I came back after taking the chap to the hospital. He said, I've got your reference, but it's not what you expect. So I didn't train you in Maths 1 and 2 and all the things that I trained you in to send you to an insurance company. I want you to take this letter over to the university. So I brought the letter to the university and I started here the next day.
Oh, very good, Peter. Yeah. So who was this? This was a teacher, or
The headmaster
at St Edmunds. At the time.
Yeah, Brother Landiner.
And he would have, I presume, had contacts all through Canberra, and ANU was one, and he thought this would be a good career. Well, it's good to have people mentoring you like that.
Yeah, it was good.
And where did you begin in a...
In the accounts section. I worked for the accountant then who...
What year was that, Peter, approximately?
62.
62.
Yep.
Yep, 62, of course you put it.
I worked for my immediate supervisor was a chap called Leo Tracy, who was a sergeant major, ex-sergeant major, so he taught me discipline and things of that kind. He was a funny man. And the accountant of the day was a chap called John Ryan. He was sort of the head of the section. And I started right at the bottom, did the banking and ran paper around the university for people to authorise payments and things of that kind. So I feel as though I've had a shot at most things in the accounting world, right at grassroots level.
And accounts then would have been in one place for the whole university. That was shortly after, I think, the old Canberra University College became part of ANU.
Yeah. It was before the Chancellery was built, and we used to actually be in the buildings just over here.
The old hut type accommodation,
It was an enjoyable time for me. Tracy was an incredibly colourful character. He'd roar like a lion. They used to call him Leo the Lion. He used to run the accounts office like a sort of a military operation. One day I discovered that I'd made a mistake. I'd actually duplicated a payment. So I went in to see him, and he was had just dialed the number on the phone, and he was just saying, hello, 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 on the phone. And then he saw what I'd done, and it completely captured his attention. And so this other person who he was talking to answered the phone, didn't get anything from him other than hello, 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 hello. And he hung up. Trey said, oh, the rude man.
And what was his name again?
Leo Tracy.
Leo Tracy. Yeah. And he was in John Ryan's section, as it were.
One day there was a girl there, a girl called Dorothy Light. He roared at Dorothy. That was just his way. There was no malice in him whatsoever. And he came out later and saw her crying. And he said, what on earth, you know, who's upset you? Let me fix it. Mr. Tracy, it was you. That was Leo.
How many people would have been in that office, in that operation?
Probably about, I would have thought, about 10. In those days, it was sort of pre-computer, right. So it was all manual. And all the payments were, there was a sort of a, when an invoice came in, there was a skirt on it, and you filled out all the various charging details, and it had the approval bits on it and all of those things. And the whole operation was completely manual. Those invoices then had to go around to various schools for authorization for payment. Then they would come back, and then they would be posted on an accounting machine that drew checks and things of that kind.
So you really were just an office boy, effectively, when you came there, and you began to learn something about accounting and the procedures.
Actually did the bank reconciliations for the ANU. I took these things around to different areas. So I got to know people in the schools. I met Don Hardman on those rounds.
What was Don doing in those
He was lab manager of, I think, genetics before it. He worked for Catcherside before it became the Research School of Biological Sciences.
That was when genetics was part of John Curtin, I think.
I was promoted out of the accounts section into the ANU, into the budget office, and worked for a chap called Lionel Norbury. There was Lionel, a secretary, a budget clerk, a qualified one, a chap called Tony Salter, and myself. We were the budget officer at the ANU at that point in time. And that's where I then got to know a lot about how the university finances worked at a higher level than processing. It was from that position that I applied for the deputy laboratory manager at the Research School of Biological Sciences and got the job.
Now, presumably sometime in the 60s you started to do accounting part-time as a learning the discipline of accounting.
She was always frustrated that I wouldn't do anything, I'd start courses and then drop them. Started an economics degree here at the ANU when I first got here. It was free for staff members and things of that kind, but I was more interested in other things as an 18 or 19-year-old than I was.
Yes.
That sort of thing. My father, as a school teacher, was never worried. He, when I actually did graduate, he said, I always knew you would. You weren't ready then. So I wasn't going to push you. I just was prepared to wait until you were ready to decide what you wanted to do. It wasn't clear. I always viewed accountants as dull and boring people. They were, you know, couldn't think outside the box, and they just recorded numbers. And I thought, my God, how could you make a career out of that? You know, so that would just be awful. Budgeting was different. It was planning. It was guessing. It was forecasting. I actually got quite interested in that.
Especially in a growing university where there's a lot of contention and tension.
I thought that was a lot of, that was, that held me and interested me.
So somewhere along the way you enrolled at University of Canberra?
Yeah, that was Hardman's fault. he had a qualification in a science qualification. I'm not sure if it was an academic one or a technical one, but he had no administrative qualifications whatsoever. And he thought to be lab manager, he needed to have the Canberra College of Advanced Education, the embryo of the at Canberra University, opened at the Canberra High School, must have been in very late 60s. He enrolled in a BA in administration, and he called me and he said, "You are doing a BA in accounting with me. If you don't, I won't confirm your appointment." Well, I think that's probably was enough incentive for me to go along. So yes. I went there and I passed all the first year subjects, surprisingly.
So you were doing this part-time, Peter, in evenings.
Yeah, I had a young family then. In the second year, I then had some economics units, and economics was not my forte, and I failed one. And that's when he said, you know, sort of, it was just brought home to me, well, you better pass it next time. That put a fair bit of pressure on me. I really was quite physically stressed by that. It probably was useful for me, as hard as it was in the end, because that was the last unit I failed, the only unit I failed in the whole course. It was a good course. I enjoyed it. I met people at the Canberra Unity. Meredith Edwards taught me econometrics, and I enjoyed that. I just gathered speed as I went along. I never got any high marks. In fact, when the head of the school was giving us a preaching from the pulpit at one time through the year, he singled me out of the whole school to say, "There's one slow-talking chap in this school who knows exactly how much study to do to pass, never to fail, other than that one time, but never to waste time because he has a young family and that sort of thing." Now, how he does that is amazing. How he can just get it right every time. In the end, we gave him 2 credits.
Who was this?
Don Mourne. He was the head of the school.
In CCAU.
Yeah. Good. Graduated in 74.
Yeah.
Earlier, I seriously wanted to leave accounts and follow science. I had a more inquiring mind than that, although budgeting did interest me. I went down to enrolled in a biological technician's course at Tech, and I thought that would hone me to then I would do a science degree after that. It must have been in my early career at RSBS, otherwise I wouldn't have. I can't think of why I did it. No, it wouldn't have been. It would have been when I was in accounts, because after I'd got to that point, I went down to see a chap in medical chemistry. He was the head tech of medical chemistry in John Curtin School at that time. He said, "Yes, we'll give you a job and you can pursue a career in this." But the tragedy was that technicians in science earned about £1,000 per annum less than I was getting as a clerk.
Yes.
And with a young family and commitments, I couldn't afford to make that change. So that was another benchmark point in my career.
Yes.
That I could have easily gone into science. And that was my chosen path.
Right, yeah.
But I stayed here.
And I suppose, Peter, there were people who could be accountants and managers within universities were not all that common, actually, and the university probably would have been reluctant to have let you go into potentially to move away from the university.
I'm not sure about that, but yeah.
Right. So, anyway, that indicates the beginnings of the connection with Don Hardman, who I, from personal experience, I know from knowing you over many years, that he and you were together for a long time.
I worked there nine years.
9 years at RSBS.
Yep. Enjoyed my time at RSBS. There was some autonomy for me in the business management, if you like, of that school, the budgeting and the accounting. I enjoyed working for various directors. I particularly enjoyed Sir Rutherford Robertson, who I think taught me a lot.
Yes.
And he actually did teach me. he was interested in me, and he nurtured me, and I valued that.
Well, he was like that for a lot of young scientists too, actually. I think he had that characteristic of being an excellent mentor for a lot of young people in this university, even in the areas that you're interested in, like planning and budgeting and so on. He could do that as well as he could do his do science. Okay, so then you moved through RSBS, and then you moved effectively back into the broader realm of the university, or into the faculties.
I applied for...
Just before we go on with that, Peter, can you give me some feeling what it was like to work in RSBS as a... with that organisation just beginning, as it were, and also you're seeing these young scientists and old scientists gather together in this organisation and try to make it do something useful and significant scientifically. What was your relationship like with the other people that were not, as it were, the managers of the...
Yeah, I enjoyed my time at RSBS. I particularly enjoyed relationships I had with the people in departments. I think I befriended many of them. I had to persuade them to... I had to form relationships with heads of departments so that they would trust me and we could get agreed budgets and that sort of thing.
Right, and these were professors. And that was in the days when professors really were professors. They were the bosses.
I can remember one story... And it's the only time I've ever seen a vote at faculty board in biological sciences, and Bob Robertson was director at the time. There was argument about the equipment budget. Bob had a view of how I'd suggested to him in an allocation, and he agreed with that, and he wanted the heads to agree to that, but they wouldn't, because in an open meeting they could see what the others were getting, and there was... this department needed at least as much as that department and more, whether they actually needed it or not. But I knew intimately what each department needed because of this relationship that I had. And it's the first time I've ever seen Bob get really quite red-faced and angry at a meeting. He was about to call a vote. So I just wrote him a note and said, Bob, I don't know what I'm not sure if I wouldn't have called him Bob, I'm sure. If you adjourn this meeting and let me go and talk to each one of the heads, I'm sure I can get them to settle out of court. Because I knew how far down the list they really wanted to go. And if I could guarantee them that privately, then I knew that it would work. So he did exactly that. He said, I'm not going to call a vote, I'm going to adjourn this meeting. Peter will now go around and discuss your needs again and we'll reconvene. I did that, and so I went and saw Dennis and all the different people and said, look, I'll guarantee you that if you agree with it. Okay, I'll do that. The meeting was reconvened, and he said, I think you've all agreed on a equipment allocation for next year. There was nods around the room without it being published. At that particular meeting, he said, then it's agreed. Meeting adjourned.
Excellent.
So I enjoyed that sort of thing.
Yes, the wrangling, the wheeling and dealing, and getting good outcomes.
I think that was what I enjoyed most. People in the Chancellery were what I would call technical accountants that worked within a bureaucracy that says that here's a set of rules that we have to adhere to. My approach was, we have a school that needs to do as much as it can on the limited resources. Mm. If the rules are going to stop that from happening, then the rules are wrong, and they need to be changed. Mm. And that got me into all sorts of hot water, and I think I got a bit of a reputation as a consequence of that, but I'm proud of that.
Personal and the unconventional approaches than the...
Yeah.
The rule book, yes. So, Peter, then from RSBS, where did you go in the university?
I went to become assistant business manager at the faculties. And there I got arts, economics and commerce, and I don't remember if it was law or Asian studies, but one other faculty, Harvey, did science, and Harvey Jones was the business manager at that time.
So you were assistant to Harvey Jones, yep, as the assistant business manager, yep, for the faculties. Yep. Yes,
but the good part about it was that I actually had Harvey let me take responsibility for three of the five faculties. It was as though I'd grown from being Don Hardman's sidekick to a more of a business manager of my own right, and I was perceived by the deans of the faculties that I was managing to be their business manager. That's where I met John Maloney. He was head of, he was in history at that point. Yeah. I think Mick Williams was the first head of Department of History when I got there.
So then you suspect graduated to become the business manager of the faculty?
I went back to the Chancellery and to become assistant bursar.
Right.
And there I think my claim to fame there was that I wrote the specifications for the stores and purchasing system that changed the university stores and purchasing system from a one that had bin cards to computerised stock balances, right, and that, yes, sort of thing. And that system held up for 20 years. It seemed to stand the test of time. It was objected to by all the storemen who didn't want to get onto terminals and computers and those sorts of things.
They like to pick up the cards,
and do that sort of thing. And yes, that worried me. I thought a bit about how to overcome that. And in line with my rather unconventional methods, I said to the chaps who were in control of the computer system, and that, why don't you just slip a poker game onto the thing? You know how you have free cell on a computer? Just put poker up there. Don't tell anybody, and I'll just get someone to leak it into the system that it's there. Within a fortnight, every storeman was using his computer terminal, and that cracked it.
That's good, Peter. Yes. So how long did that...
I was there for about 3 years. Russell Boardman was the bursar, and I had it, and again, I enjoyed that. And then, unfortunately, Harvey died, applied for his position and got it.
So you became business manager,
yeah,
for the faculties.
Yeah.
Then you basically managed the faculties.
Yeah, I was there for, managed the faculties for 15 years.
Yes, I thought you were there for a long time.
Yeah. I worked closely with the chair of the board of the faculties, and during that time I had a four-year stint on the university's council representing general staff. I thoroughly enjoyed that job, and that was enough. You know, I was pleased that I didn't become a scientist in the end, or who knows. But that interested me. The challenges there were enormous.
Yeah. So maybe you could expand on that a bit in terms of working in the faculties with people who are now part of the undergraduate teaching part of the university, where undoubtedly the needs and the detail of the work there would have been quite different to what they were in Research School of Biological Sciences, for example.
Yep. Again, I mean, the work in areas was different, of course, to what happened in a research school, but the principles that you applied were, that you used, weren't different. If you, in my view, there are three kinds of administration, and there's, or administrative requirements. One is, if you like, in industry. And in industry, the objective there is to maximise the wealth of the company, the shareholders' returns and that sort of thing. So everything you do is focused in that direction. It's to increase the wealth of a particular company. In the bureaucracy, there's a set of rules that says that you have to treat everybody fairly. And if you don't adhere strictly to the rules, then somebody might get unfair treatment, and somebody else could object to preferential treatment that somebody else got. The third kind is in the sector we work in, and you could put other things in there like hospitals, and you work with scarce resources to get outcomes that benefit people. And the rules in each of those places are entirely different. People didn't in those days really appreciate that. They would take people that were successful in one area and bring them into another. And some people could make a successful transition and change to the new environment. Others couldn't, and we suffered a lot as a consequence of that. And people isolated in administration tended towards the bureaucratic approach rather than the third kind of approach.
Yes.
And if you did that, then you would stifle a place. I found it necessary to challenge the middle that way, probably brought about my demise in the end, but that I enjoyed.
Yes.
And
yes.
What frustrated the Chancellery was that I was actually a qualified accountant. So I had the same credentials they had, so they couldn't argue with me saying that my knowledge base wasn't equal to theirs. So at budget reviews and things like that, I was on an equal footing.
Right, yes.
And I enjoyed that.
Now, in the day-to-day operations of the faculty's business manager's office, you in particular would have immediate operational boss would be the chairman of...
The board of the faculties,
yes. Yes, yes. Did the deans have any role in that, individually?
No, I answered to the chair of the board of the faculties, right. But I supported the deans.
Yes.
And I was part of their deans meetings and resources committee meetings, and I serviced those with information they wanted and contributed to those meetings. I would represent the faculties at various university forums that were appropriate, such as the budget review. I enjoyed budget review. It was a quarterly event where you went and argued for more money for the faculty. So the exercise there was to plead a case for more resources. So one had to be inventive and imaginative in what story you would tell that would persuade the rest of the university that your needs were more pressing than anywhere else. And that was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that. 15 years, so that was just good.
Yes.
Yep.
So you would have seen chairs of the boards of the faculties, what, about one every 3 or 4 years,
yep.
Something like that,
yep.
Peter?
I think the first one that got appointed me was a lawyer. I'll come back to you with that name.
Yep. Yeah.
Eric Batchelard. I was with Eric at the time. Amalgamation was...
A big issue.
Dean Tyrrell was chair of the board. I worked for him. And Richard Campbell.
Campbell, yes.
They're the ones.
Did their skills as manager vary much? I don't want you to name any names here, but was there much variation? I see, because these are
Douglas,
people who are not...
Douglas was the first guy. Douglas Whalen.
Whalen. Anyway, did they vary much in their skills?
Their styles were completely different.
Were they?
Yeah, completely different. Eric's was based on logic and common sense, if you like. Probably learning a lot in Douglas's time since I just got there. But I was always a confident person and full of my own self-confidence. And it's not until you mature in life that you see that the things that you're absolutely certain about weren't necessarily that correct after all. Mm. But at the time, I was persuaded by everything that I was doing and believed in it. And it's easy then to argue it if you do have that belief and commitment. Dean was more of a technocrat in administration.
Mm.
He cared about process and would put formulas to a lot of things. And Richard was Richard.
Yeah.
He's different.
But they were all effective in the end, were they, Peter?
Yes, I believe they were.
Yeah, they did what was necessary.
Yeah,
they
all cared about the faculties, and their styles were different. And some of them, I think, their personal styles were better than others. But there's no doubting their commitment. I think the faculties grew all the while I was there.
Now there is, as you would well know, probably better than most of us, that the move in universities these days is in fact to appoint executive deans and executive chairmen of various of these boards rather than to pick, as it were, senior academics and graft onto them. Do you have any comment about that?
Yes, I do. In my time, I didn't expect the dean or the chair to be a skilled administrator or a skilled budgeter or those sorts of things. Yeah. That's the ingredient that I added. What they needed to know most was what's best for their area, which direction was it going into, what lines of research to support.
Education, judgment, basically.
And it's the mix of those two things that's important.
Mm.
What they're looking for now is that combined in a single person. and I'm not in a position to know whether that is better. My feeling is that it's difficult to be both. There's a case to have both, and maybe that's old school, and that's what I grew up with, but that's how I would look at it. There are exceptions to that. Bob Robertson was an exception to that. A number of other exceptions. Duke Payton in science, Chris Bryant, Bill Ramson. There are a number of exceptions to that, but those people all concentrated on their particular expertise or what, you know, their interests, and let me advise them in the other areas. They would critically evaluate it, but they wouldn't spend the energy worrying about it as a person of the kind you're talking about would have to.
So at the end of your time as the business manager of the faculties, where to next?
I think Chris Burgess probably brought about changes. For some reason, I worried Chris. I think that
Chris Burgess was?
He was the Pro Vice Chancellor of Finance.
Was he an accountant or was he an academic?
No, he was an administrator. I was on his selection committee, and I thought he would bring great value to the uni. I liked his ideas. He was very fluent. In fact, he was so fluent, I thought I was good with words. He could outdo me. I'll tell a story. I don't know if it's appropriate, but towards the end of my career in the faculties, I was summoned to finance committee. Philip Ruddock was on finance committee and some pretty notable people. And the issue was that I'd got the faculties into a $10 million deficit. And so I went along, and that, to my knowledge, was absolute rubbish.
This is while you were business manager,
yeah.
Peter.
Yeah, and Chris Burgess addressed finance committee, and I thought, wow, how could I have messed the faculties up so badly? You know, that, and he's telling me about stuff that I know, but he's saying it so plausibly that I'm persuaded that I've screwed up, you know, sort of. And then, hey, hang on, he says it, all of that is wrong. And the chair of the board of the faculties is there with me. I said, look, let's analyse this $10 million worth of deficit. $5 million deficit, you say, is in special purpose funds. That's where people apply for grants. And so that they can start working, we let them go before the actual money comes in sometimes. But collectively, special purpose funds were $7 million in surplus. But he said, but what if all the people drew out their money, then you'd be in deficit $5 million. The money is guaranteed, it's coming, was my answer. And I said, well, you take a bank lends money. If all the depositors took out their money, then the bank would be bankrupt, because it's lent it, you know, banks don't go bankrupt. Our job is to get research done, and we're not going to say to people, stop and wait until every cent is in the bank, when we know that it's a signed agreement and it's coming. I submit that's not really a deficit. Okay, let's go on to the next part. There was a $4 million deficit in the faculty's building program. You'll remember SPAM, the space planning thing, where we move Faculty of Science all around. That had to be financed. Finance committee agreed that we could spend that money and pay it off out of the certain income of the capital component of overseas student income. It was coming in on a regular basis, and it was going absolutely to plan. It was an agreed strategy. The other deficit was a $2 million deficit, and that was a legitimate deficit, but it was agreed by Resources Committee, and it was covered by a $2 million surplus that the Faculty of Economics and Commerce had, that the dean of the day had agreed that we could call on if we were caught, because all of this was part of a rigorous negotiation at Resources Committee. Well, why Chris had the need to start that whole process worried me, and it just sort of deteriorated my job, and I never resiled from it. Was to continue to argue for the faculties. And I had the support of the deans and the chair. Maybe it was the level of support I had that worried him. I'm not sure.
This is related to your leaving of the faculty.
Yeah, he caused a review. then they decided that rather to have a single business manager, they would put a business manager in each of the faculties. And there's a logic to that. But then I was taken to the Chancellery, to his section, and made subservient to him.
So he could keep an eye on
you. Yeah.
And what did you do there?
I worked with in the university's development office, which was growing the alumni fund and forming relationships with outside sectors.
Right.
And I actually enjoyed that. I agreed that I didn't enjoy the alumnus part. That's fundraising. That's not my forte. It was negotiating and working out collaborations that I thought was useful.
Yeah.
In the faculties, I'd actually written a little yellow book, which was called Expanding the Faculty's Resource Base, which was gathered together all of the various strategies that you could, that I could give to deans and heads of departments for attracting income other than the government subvention.
Right, ideas that you would know about by virtue of your experience, but they wouldn't as they came into the job.
I think the last nail in the coffin was over the Kiola thing. Through my career, I was on various, I mentioned once I was on council, I was chair of the Burton Garran Management Committee, for instance, but I was also on the Kiola Committee, and Chris wanted to give Judith Wright's property at Braidwood away and Kiola away. He would give it to the University of Wollongong, Kiola for a dollar. He ended up giving the Judith Wright's property at Braidwood to some scouting thing, or Duke of Edinburgh.
Very generous.
Yeah. That was wrong for so many reasons, and not the least of which, even from a moral view of someone giving us a bequest and us not valuing it, it sends a sad message. But there's just so many reasons why you shouldn't do that. So I mounted a campaign to hold Kiola, or supported a campaign to hold Kiola, and there was a showdown meeting in the Chancellery where Chris was at, and Henry Nix chaired it, and it had a room full of people.
Supporters or antagonists?
Well, people to decide what to do. I persuaded that meeting to
keep Kiola,
yes. And I knew then I was...
So that explains your great interest in Kiola while you're here at Emeritus Faculty.
Yeah, that I was for the high jump, sort of. And I have to say that I wasn't at all worried about... I wasn't being noble or whatever. I'd always intended to retire 2 days before I was 55 because that was the best option for somebody in my position. Having worked so long in the Commonwealth Super Scheme, you would have had to stay on working till you were 64 to get the same pension. And with the way Sue's health was at the time and with how things had developed, I was, I've contributed what I have to contribute now, and it's time for me to go. As people said, you put your job on the line. It wasn't. It may have appeared that, but I wasn't that honourable.
Well, even so, a lot of people saw it in that fashion.
Yeah.
Where had Chris Burgess come from?
He came from the University of Sydney. It was interesting that in his CV, he'd never worked in any uni longer than 3 years, and we saw that as a positive rather than saying, well, I wonder, someone should have asked why. And he didn't stay here for very much longer after Chubby came.
Yes.
He absolutely snowed Dean. I've no trouble with Dean at all. As I've said,
Dean Terrell, with
the velvet tongue, he did to Dean what he did to me. And persuaded me I was wrong when I wasn't. He had that gift.
Yes.
Yeah.
Where did he go to from here?
I'm not sure. I don't have any animosity to Chris. If I met him now, I'm not sure if he's still alive, actually. I would have a beer with him, and I would say the things I've said to you to him.
Yes.
I don't have any problems about that. Yeah. That was a fair fight, a good game.
So effectively you took early retirement then, Peter. And what did you do with that new freedom?
I took up with Giles, the secretariat of ADEM, which is an organisation that looks after professional development for people in the sector, and more recently a more focused one on for people in buildings and grounds, facility services,
You mean at ANU or generally?
Generally,
People working in...
A second contract, yeah.
Right, yes.
Secretary for that one, TEFMA. Look after the Emeritus Faculty, I enjoyed university life, and it was... I worried about going from... that. You know, I'd spent my whole life here, what would I do if I just walked away? But it's the transition's been...
Smooth and beneficial.
I haven't even noticed it, sort of...
And realisation of your... potential in other ways,
I've enjoyed. I enjoy what I'm doing now. It's fun. I probably do a little bit too much. I look after Pegasus. I'm the treasurer for Pegasus, writing for the disabled, and treasurer for the National Brain Injury Foundation. And as treasurer, you get too involved in the operations of those things. So if you take those to TEFMA, ADEM, Emeritus Faculty. I've got my five faculties back, and I look forward to holidays again.
Get away from it all. Yes,
and I play with these rogues at tennis, which I thoroughly enjoy.
Yeah,
and so there's certain things that meetings have to be put off. Tennis is on. That's more important.
Yes.
Except for yesterday, where somebody appealed to me. They have a council meeting in December, and yesterday was their close of business, and I knew. They wanted a report. I'll do that.
Yes. Peter, well, let's just backtrack, as it were, to your early retirement and what you're doing now. I've got a feel for that in the sense of the generality of it. Two things you did. You became part of the operation called ATEM, Australian Tertiary Education Managers.
Management.
And that's a professional organisation
that
looks after the interests of people like yourself who had been managers in universities. And
no, it looks after the professional development of administrators that work in the sector. So we run training courses and try and develop them in their careers.
Right.
There's about 1,300 members,
right,
individual members. Every university in Australia, less about two, are corporate members. And see, a significant number of New Zealand institutions are corporate members. CIT is a corporate member. There aren't that many TAFEs, but there are a few. There's one in WA. It's mainly universities, although we've tried to infiltrate the TAFE market, but they don't seem to be that interested in us.
Okay. And your role in that is as the treasurer?
Yeah. Oh, I support the treasurer. I do all their accounting and finance work and that sort of thing.
You've done that basically since you...
Actually started 2 months before I left the university, right, which we won't talk about.
Yes, okay. And the other one was infrastructure or...
The buildings and grounds lot. Exactly the same process. My involvement there is to a lesser degree. The treasurer in TEFMA plays a more...
That's called TEFMA.
T-E-F-M-A.
A-T-E.
Tertiary Education Facilities Management.
So again, it's for that group now who are directly involved in what we call buildings and grounds.
Whatever it's called these days. And they look after
asset management. And so again, you're supporting the business operation of that, the accounting so on. So they're two professional activities that you continue to conduct. And I guess your role as the treasurer of this organisation, Emeritus Faculty, is the same sort of thing.
Yeah.
A more specialised one, as it were.
As it is for the two other organisations that I'm writing for, the disabled and the National Brain Injury Foundation. And I'm the treasurer, but there are office people in those organisations that actually do the office work that I do for the other three that we talked about.
Now,
so I have more of a controlling role in those ones.
Now, there's another one called the Meningans.
Meningans.
That's after a famous rugby league footballer,
yep.
Mal Meninga.
Yeah, I inherited that. Dick Johnson, I think, and Jeff Corwell started the Meningans up. I think it was an acknowledgement that people in the players in the Raiders weren't actually rocket scientists, and they wanted to try and remedy that. So they wanted to generate a source of income that they could award to deserving members of the Raiders to do some sort of tertiary course that would serve them once their football career was finished. And unfortunately, Jeff passed on, and I agreed to carry it on after him, which I do.
Is it succeeding in terms of providing opportunities?
Yeah, each year we give a couple of scholarships here. Yeah.
Now, these are, as it were, your contributions back to the community and society,
yep,
that sort of thing.
Yep.
Do you have a philosophical view about that, Peter? I mean, do you think that we owe it to the world? Or is this just something personal for you? Is this a generalisation that could be made for everybody, say, an emeritus faculty? Why aren't you a member of a charitable organisation, for example?
It's just something that I do. There's a need there. I have the particular set of skills that you need. I've got the credentials that give them, they can put on their reporting to governments and that right. They've got somebody professional who's doing these sorts of things, although I'm not any longer, I'm retired, if you like. I haven't kept up my professional qualification or training, yeah, and updated, and I make that perfect, you know, that clear.
Yeah.
But I've still got my old ticket.
You also engage in a fair bit of fishing, travel.
Yeah, I enjoy the outdoors, and I enjoy tennis a lot more than I thought I would, and I look forward to it now.
Yeah.
I mean, I have for a while. I think it's healthy. I like the people there. I've known some of them from an earlier life, even, which is interesting. Yeah,
These are part of your that balance of life that people need to.
Yeah.
You get enough cerebral stuff in here at the Emeritus.
And I enjoy gardening.
When you were at ANU, did you engage in any activities at all with those which were not, for example, with sports clubs or with student group or with any cultural aspects of what was going on the campus?
When I was young, I played cricket in social clubs attached to areas that I worked in. There was an administrative team. I played in the town versus gown match. Colin Plowman was captain of a team that had some significance in my early years. I played a little bit of social football, rugby, but that's all.
What do you think is different about this university now compared with when you first came to it?
I marvel at the amount of building that's going on.
Mm.
Resources were really quite hard when I was here to finance. I talked about that issue of the $10 million deficit. Mm. For us to get $4 million to refurbish the Faculty of Science was a major undertaking in those days.
Yes.
There weren't new buildings going up as they are now. The administrative structure has all changed, and Chubb has moved to a Caltech model of integrating teaching into research to form schools across
the old parts of the university, the research on one hand, the teaching on the other. Yeah,
I've got a funny, unusual approach to things. I take the set of circumstances I'm placed with and try and optimise those without being too judgmental about whether that's the right set at that particular point. I can see the benefits of the old administrative arrangements. We talked a little bit about the move towards a single specialist administrator running areas that's got academic and administrative, a combination of that. I think would be harder to find. My view there is, as I've given you before, is that there are two specialist things, and mixing the two is not, in my view, not necessarily best. And I talked about different kinds of administration, and I take that even down to that level, that it's not always possible for one person to move from one that has an understanding of one to have an understanding of the other two. I wouldn't be judgmental about the shift from the new academic arrangements and that sort of thing. I watch those things, but I really don't believe in the ANU. Nothing there dismays me. You know, I'm not, so I leave well enough alone. I don't. It's not in my. If I was asked to contribute in some way, then I would get involved and explore it and that sort of thing. But I'm not open enough to think about without worrying about that.
Right. Well, let me pin you down on that, in the sense of Kiala. You've been through the battle of Kiala, as it were. What was it or is it that connects Kiala to ANU that's important in your mind?
It's important on many fronts. It expands the opportunity for the ANU. ANU's landlocked. It offers it a coastal precinct. Mm. One of the great disappointments that I have is that I was personally involved in negotiating a sliver of land from the existing Kiala boundaries through to the highway. Mm-hmm. It was actually owned by Joy London, and she bequeathed that to the National Heart Foundation and a couple of other organisations who weren't really sure what to do with it. Mm-hmm. So I went and negotiated with them all. I went to Sydney and talked to the head of the National Heart Foundation, who was actually related to Laurie Nicholson. And for a peppercorn amount of money, we could have owned that, but Chris didn't see the value in that and wasn't prepared to agree to it, so all of those negotiations went for naught. Had we got it, that would have offered huge biodiversity opportunities for work, because the land from the coast through to the highways offers so much diversity that's incredible.
So it would have been a good Qing research facility, for, as it were.
Yep. You just don't get things for the sake of getting them. There's got to be a purpose. It's a valuable piece of land, but that's the least important reason for having it, in my view. That doesn't even come into on the radar as far as I'm concerned. The coastal campus of the ANU gives prospective students a view that we can offer you the sea as well as any Sydney University or Melbourne University or any other of the sandstone universities. So, there are just so many reasons. And also, it was bequeathed to us. You've got to respect that. If you want to get bequests, which are valuable in terms of creating opportunity for you, then if you're not going to respect that, then don't do it.
Mm, yeah. Exactly. People might say, well, how would I know? Yeah. And the answer is, before you bequeath something, you check it out.
Yeah, and you wouldn't give it away, you know, sort of.
Now, let me also go back into your career and ask you, looking over the whole length of it, Peter, are there standout people for you? Well, first of all, at the level of their importance to the university, the people you might have encountered and on the campus and working with them or not, who you thought as being very significant, and also those who were important to you as a person, that is, the people who mentored you, who provided you with the sorts of examples of what your career and life might be.
That's an incredibly hard question. I've been extremely lucky with my time at the uni in that all of the relationships that I've had have been good, and I've enjoyed each one of them. Mm. I used to say at one point I had 55 heads of departments. It was my job to try and help them get as far down the track as I could to save them administrative burden as far as possible. If I went in there in a suit, they would see me as the tax collector or the law, and then they would spend time working out why it is they couldn't do what it was that I wanted them to do. The best way was to go in just dressed casually.
Looking like them.
Yep. And talking about them and finding out what interested them. Yeah. I had a definite agenda, asking them questions about their operation and learning, but then picking on, steering it as far as possible to where I wanted it, and then get them to suggest what it was that I wanted them to do, and then telling them that I would go away and try and make that work for them, was far better than if I bought a decree from Chancery to say we have to do this, then they would spend the rest of the week worrying about that when they should have been doing something else. Standout, that's not the question you asked me. Bob Robertson had to be one. Mm. Bill Ramson had to be one. Would you believe Duke Payton, who was...
Mm, I do believe.
Yeah, that. Chris Bryant, Eric Batchelard, Doug Whalen, Dean, Alan Barton, and individual heads of departments. If I had my life again, I would do what I did this time, mm. and hope that I had that opportunity to work with that many people, mm. and develop the relationships that I had with them. Mm. Mulvaney, you could just go on, you yeah. know, sort of
people you respected and admired,
yeah, and that I worked with, yeah. As, yeah.
And it's nice to know about at least one life, Peter, that has been near to, well, not necessarily perfect,
oh,
but
yeah,
very
no,
satisfying.
No, it's satisfying, but yeah. I would have done it harder. My personal attributes, I was too wild. What am I trying to say? I'd lead the high life as well as the do my work, you know, yeah, sort of. Yeah. I could have been a lot more responsible, let me put it to you that way. Yeah. Okay.
If you could select any, I mean, were there any turning points in your life where you were confronted, as it were, with will I do this or will I do that, and you did whatever you did, and not in the sense of finding any regrets, or but which were important in terms of you becoming who you were to become?
I think Tracy helped me a lot, first up, mm. and I think Lionel Norbury, who was the budget officer, nurtured me a lot. In those early days.
Yeah.
I always took an open view of things and I always cared about what I did, and I'd think about it a lot all the while before giving advice to someone. And I don't know how much I've influenced the faculties by saying to a chair or a dean, well, I can help you do this, or go away and work out how for them to do it, and then yeah. come back and give them the opportunity to do it.
And your headmaster, I dare say,
yeah.
by taking the initiative,
yeah,
saying,
yeah.
why don't you try a...
Yeah. And Hardman for saying, look, I'll fire you if you yeah. don't get yes. a degree. In terms of work, that's hard for me to pick out, because if that's what you're asking me, because there, you know, over that many years in the position I had, I think I developed models for distributing funds through the faculties. I'm sure... It's hard for me to answer that, I'm not sure.
Sure, yeah. yes.
Yeah. And any one thing is, you know, just that's what I did, fighting for the faculties at budget review and coming concocting up atrocious yarns to win us resources, you know, yeah, sort of yes. to the point where people would laugh. There was a budget review was where all the business managers went there, and you were in an open forum, and you were left to your own wits to persuade the ensemble. There's, anecdotally, there was a funny story there. Peter Grimshaw had a particular style when he was arguing for the joint schools. Peter's style was to quote chapter and verse, and he would quote legislation, and that was his forte, and he would say, paragraph B, subsection 2, part 4, and I'll quote, and he would come off with this thing. And Don was at a particular budget review, and Peter had spoken for about half an hour and saying that he needed a new fire engine from somewhere or whatever it was. Don said, Peter, I have no idea what you were talking about. And he said, well, Don, yes, of course I can understand that. And then he went on with another 20-minute diatribe, and people just shook their head, you know. He was just too good. So these things occur to me through every facet of my work, and heads of departments meetings were special because of the discussions and the debate. I told you about a faculty board meeting in RSPS, but those things happened across... each of the faculties, and I'd go along and I'd be a part of that, because finances are always part of a faculty meeting or a faculty board meeting or whatever, and I'd be the person there talking about that.
Yes.
Yep.
And you probably had more insight into what was going on, because resources in the end are what drives, well, I guess, yeah, anything yeah, in any yeah. organisation, but in a university in particular, to satisfy the egos of all those mad academics.
And that's the importance of knowing those 55 heads of departments. Mm. That's the importance at RSBS of knowing where the cut-off was point for each one, and that would fit yeah. within the yes. in the allocations. And saying to Bob, look, you lose it if you call a vote now. Mm. Let me talk to them.
They've got an open-ended list, yeah, and what you yeah, can do is yeah, find the yeah, point at which yeah, they will be satisfied.
And I did that, at the meeting, and I knew I could fit it. But at a meeting, they wouldn't, in that context, at that particular point in time, I could see that they wouldn't agree to it.
Well, your story is really very interesting, I think, Peter, on the basis that it reminds me, I think, of one of the CEOs of Woolworths a few years ago, who was a guy who started in Woolworths as a shelf packer or something like that, or a checkout boy, and slowly worked his way up through the system, then became CEO. Well, I'm not accusing you of becoming CEO of ANU, but it's unusual in the sense that, well, perhaps it wasn't so unusual in your day that somebody would go and begin work with an organisation and find themselves still there at the end of 45 years.
The thing about the ANU is it's so diverse. If you look at it, it's a city in its own right.
Mm.
I haven't worked in personnel office, and I didn't work in buildings and grounds.
Mm.
But I think I worked in most other areas of the university. Yes. And you move from administration to the faculties to RSBS to the Chancellery to here.
Mm.
They're new career moves. You're dealing with, in the faculties, with such diversity. It's a real challenge to be able to understand what each one of those 55 departments does to the point where you can actually persuade the head of the department that you're on that person's side, supporting them, and you're their advocate. And they trust you to be their advocate. And I found that absolutely challenging.
Yeah, that idea of trust from the people that you're working for.
Yeah. If you don't have the trust, you can't help them.
Yes.
And that's where that's the difference between those sectors we talked about. Trust isn't required in a bureaucracy. In fact, it's almost it would stop you being a bureaucrat in the purest sense.
That's right, yes, and according to the book, as it were.
Yes.
Just a couple of personal matters, Peter. Now, I know your first wife died some years ago. Your children are still in Canberra, are they?
Yep. I've got one in Perth. I've got two in Canberra.
Right.
One with four kids and one with three.
Right.
And the one in Perth has now got two.
You're repartnered.
Have
your children shown any inclination to follow in the footsteps of their father?
No, perhaps my daughters have, not my son.
Mm.
My eldest daughter's expertise is computing, and she works in the Department of Health. And my second daughter did food technology. She did a BSc at Canberra Uni.
Right.
So they've both got tertiary qualifications, but they're both predominantly mums now. My son's a cabinet maker. He's never been an academic, aspired to be an academic, but he's a very nice person.
Now, Peter, is there anything that I haven't talked to you about that you would like to talk about or put on the record or make comment about in any way?
I don't think so. During that amount of time, with the positions that I had, that I'd been through many experiences that probably influenced the way the uni is now, and to single out any and to talk about any particular ones is hard. We talked about the changes in the Faculty of Science, moving people around the buildings and all of the machinations that went on there. To get that to work was really quite a challenge. To get political science to move from where they were in the faculties around to another part of the building was a momentous thing to do.
Yeah.
Beryl Rawson and I were actually put up against the wall and we were going to be machine gunned, in Asian studies, I can remember some momentous issues there that I had to go to faculty and stand up in front of faculty and persuade them of something, and they didn't want to do it. I was able to persuade them because they trusted me. We will do that. And it was in terms of some financial restructure or some financial strategy that was important at the time. And I can remember being called a crass bureaucrat by one of them at the faculty meeting. And that actually helped me because four or five of the heads of other heads of departments turned around and said, you can't call him that, you know, and that, then they argued amongst themselves and it was carried. Had he not said that, it would have...
Might have had a struggle.
Yeah. As I said, I've been a very lucky person. That's been good. And not without its warts, don't ever get me wrong. Some dreadful mistakes, you know, and things I blush about, but that's life.
Yes,
you know?
That's right. Well, as a citation for you, Peter, to end this, let me say, because you and I have been in the university, I came in 1969, so...
We've known each other a long time,
From my first appointment to the Research School of Biological Sciences and meeting you in the laboratory manager's operation there, let me say how good it has been to deal with you and to have somebody who is completely lacking in the view of themselves that because you're in charge of the money, then the world has got to listen to you, and to have instead said, well, I'm not really in charge of the money, but I've got a fair say in how it's going to be distributed, and I want to hear what is necessary, what is important so far as the university is concerned, either through its research in RSBS or in terms of the balancing of the distribution in the Department of Biochemistry in the Faculty of Science. And you've always been a pleasure to deal with, Peter, because you're so amenable, and that doesn't mean that people will get their way with you, but at least there is a person there, a real life person who has a pretty good idea, and I think this is a consequence of you having grown up in the system, that you do really understand it in a way that an outsider doesn't understand it. It's like having someone in the family who helps to decide the important issues. And it's been a real privilege for me to have worked with you over the years, and great fortune again to have arrived in Emeritus Faculty and found you here in charge of the books. So thanks, Peter, for the opportunity over the years to have been your friend and to have been your co-worker, as it were.
Thank you, Peter. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
In this interview, we heard from Peter Scardoni, previously business manager, budget officer, and a senior financial planner in the university. Peter is now honorary treasurer of ANU Emeritus Faculty and provides volunteer help to a number of professional societies and charitable organisations off campus. The interview is part of the Emeritus Faculty's Oral History Program and was conducted in December 2009 at the faculty office. The interviewer was Peter Stewart and the audio engineer Nick Fominis.